something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Tour, 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 live shows, da-da-da-da-da-da,
tour.
It's baseball season.
Yeah, that's right, it is.
That means we're going on tour, right?
Yeah.
Josh, Seattle and Portland are sold out.
I know, we'll see you guys there.
Denver, Colorado, you are very close to selling out.
Colorado, Denver is like right there, right? And then Houston's doing okay. It's respectable, but it's definitely, Denver was like, give us those tickets.
Yeah, and I got to say, Houston, we really stuck our neck out for you after Dallas and Austin. We heard from a lot of Houstonites about how big your city is. Mm-hmm. So prove it.
Oh, so they call throwing on the gauntlet, Chuck.
And we have two more shows to announce. Is that correct, sir?
That's right. We are doing night one and night two at the Bell House in New York City.
That's right. In Brooklyn, New York. Bell House has been our home there for many years.
Yeah.
And
coming back home.
Yeah, these are very special shows because they're smaller than places we've been playing.
Right.
And we love it there. And I think it's going to be pretty great.
Yeah, it is. So that's June 29th and June 30th. And tickets go on sale this Friday.
That is correct. And we will have links at our Squarespace website, SYSKlive.com.
Yeah.
Make sure you buy tickets to the correct night that you want to go.
Oh, yeah. And it's going to be the same show both nights, right?
Be the same show both nights. And now all I need are tickets from Lin-Manuel Miranda to go see Hamilton on Broadway.
Oh, yeah, sure. Sign me up for those as well, please.
It's a pretty tough ticket to get. So if you're a listener, sir, you could come to our show.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally.
Even though it conflicts with the Hamilton performance.
Skip it.
Yeah. That's what I say. So, like we said, SYSKlive.com, powered by Squarespace, so you can find all the tour deets.
Yep.
We'll see you soon, Brooklyn.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark, and there's Charles W. Chuck Bryant, and there's Jerry over there. I can hear. This is Stuff You Should Know.
We're working. And that means we're not on strike.
That's right.
Strike.
Remember the Flintstones?
No.
Betty and Wilma used to wander around shouting strike.
Why? Because they were tired of being subjugated
housewives? No recollection of that. I just remember seeing them like pumping their hands in the air, shouting strike.
Interesting. So, as a little background, if you want to go listen first to our show from May 2012, How Labor Unions Work.
Good one.
Might be a good little precursor to this.
Yeah.
Because they are tied together like ham and cheese.
Yeah, because you really can't have a strike without a union.
You can.
You can, but you're probably in trouble if you do.
Yeah.
For the most part.
Yeah. I mean, technically, we could all at How Stuff Works decide to go on strike. We're not in a union.
Yeah.
Like, we could all walk out and say, we want free lunch, or we're not podcasting anymore.
Free lunch would be great.
So technically you could do it, but I don't know about the legalities of stuff like that.
Well, that's the thing.
Yeah.
Okay, so we could do it. You're absolutely right. But we wouldn't be afforded the same legal protections that strikers who are striking under a labor union are.
Yeah.
Plus,
our boss would probably say, well, let me see if we can work out free lunch.
We'd be like, man, we burned a strike on that.
All right.
It would be a problem if we burned a strike on that because strikes are the last They're basically the last resort of any labor union.
Yeah, labor union doesn't say, you know, I wish we were paid more. Let's go on strike tomorrow.
Yeah, no, it doesn't happen like
no,
that.
No, you try to work it out with your employer first.
Right.
Sit down at the negotiating table.
Yeah.
Well, we're jumping ahead here.
Oh, okay.
Let's get to some history.
Oh, you want to talk about this, the history of strikes?
Yeah, not a lot is known about the very first strike, but they do know that the word was used in the 1700s, and it probably means, because I kind of wondered, what does that mean? It probably means, came from, like, to strike a blow.
Yeah, like a punch in the mouth.
Yeah, like from, to strike someone.
From labor to capital.
That's right.
They're saying, hey, man, you can't push this around. And it was it's a really important right to be able to strike, or it
sure.
was for a very long time, because back in the day, if you worked in a town in Massachusetts or something like that in the late 18th century, there's probably one company in that town. And so therefore that company had what's called the monopsony.
Yeah.
Meaning that they were the only employer around. So they had they could decide what they paid you and what were you going to do? You can't
right.
take a horse 50 miles to work every day to the next town.
Yeah.
So, to counteract this monopsony of the employer, the ability for the workers to get together and say, hey, we are going to not work and you will not have the product that we make for you unless we come to some agreement over these labor conditions and wages and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah,
that's where they came from.
One of the first strikes was in 1786 when some printers in Philadelphia said, you know what? We want a raise. And the company said,
nope.
No, thank you. We'll pay you just like you're paid. They said, all right, well, you know what? We're not going to print anything. And it worked. They quit working and they ended up getting their raise.
Right. The owner was like, I hadn't expected this outcome.
How dare you?
Yeah.
So, because it worked, over the next few decades, other, people said the same thing. If we're all in the same profession, let's, band together and say, we want to be treated more fairly. We're making this company a ton of money.
Yeah.
They're paying us squat. It's not safe. We're working too long.
Oh, yeah. Little kids are working here.
Yeah. Child labor's going on. So this is, we're powerless as an individual to walk in and say, you know, I want more pay, because they will say you're fired. But if we band together, we actually have some bargaining power.
Exactly. And that's what a union is. It's an assemblage of workers who share some sort of commonality. Either they work for the same company. Usually they work in the same trade.
Sure.
So like electrical workers in a company plant will all belong to one union, and the upholsterers will belong to another union, and so on and so forth, right?
Yeah.
So you have a bunch of different unions in the same plant for working for a same company.
Right.
But so usually the thing that binds workers in a union is their trade, right? And when they get together and they say, no more, we're not working anymore until you guys do something, that is power, and that's the strike. But again, there's supposed to be bargaining that comes before this.
Yeah. Strikes are a bit of a double-edged sword. Your company is going to very quickly cease to make money because things aren't being produced. A lot of money, which is a big deal, but
sure.
You as strikers are also not making money.
Right.
You might have what's called a war chest built up when your union has set aside money in case of a strike. But it's not going to carry you through a prolonged strike, and it's not going to be your regular paycheck. So a war chest is not going to solve your problem ultimately if it becomes a battle of wills.
Yeah.
And both sides are dug in for months and even years.
And apparently, so Europe's very well known for strikes. Like it seems like France was striking like every couple of weeks for a while there, right?
Yeah.
But it turns out that the U.S. has struck – gone on strike. How about that?
Sure.
About as often as Europe has.
Oh, yeah?
From something like, I think, the 1880s till the 1970s. And has actually had bloodier strikes and longer strikes. So that the mean number of days a strike lasts in the United States, or did between 1881 and 1974, was 20 days.
Wow.
So, yeah, if you're like a wage laborer, that's 3 weeks' pay
yeah.
that you're losing out on. That's the mean, you know. It could go longer than that.
Yeah, and that's exactly what is going on in the boardroom for the company. Is there, you know, how long can we wait them out? How long can they wait us out? It's a game of chess in a lot of ways.
Right.
And like you said, it is a last resort. A union can't just call a strike. A union leader, or the upper management of the union can't just say, we're going on strike. You got to put it to a vote, and it's not like 51%. Like, generally, it's 80% or up.
Right.
People have to be behind it, and which is what you want, because if your labor pool isn't strong and your union isn't strong, then you're going to lose.
Exactly.
They're going to start crossing that picket line. We'll get to all that, of course, but,
But even beyond that, the union leadership has to be smart enough to say, guys, like, we know that 80% of you are voting for this, and that's the gender neutral, guys. Stop your email now. but this is a terrible time to go on strike. Like, we don't have public sympathy.
Which is economics, a big part of it.
Yeah, big time.
Yeah.
The economics are against us. The brand recognition and brand loyalty of the company we work for is through the roof. It's a terrible time to strike. So if that happens and the workers are disaffected enough, they may say, no, we're going on strike anyway, without the blessing of the union. That's what's called a wildcat strike.
Yes. And also, I think the name of a Blackfoot album.
Who's Blackfoot?
What?
Are they newish?
No.
Are they from the 70s?
80s. They were a Southern rock band.
Atlanta Rhythm Section.
No. I used to love them too.
Blackfoot?
Yeah, they were, I think like either 2/3 or 3/4 of the band were, Native American.
Uh-huh.
And so they were Blackfoot. And the lead singer, was in a very early incarnation of Lynyrd Skynyrd and is now with Lynyrd Skynyrd again.
I see.
Ricky Medlock. Wow.
I've never heard of Blackfoot.
Yeah, they're
I'm
great.
Sorry for that, Blackfoot guys.
They're a hard rock, Southern rock band.
Cool. It sounds like something I'd like.
Yeah. Go listen to the Blackfoot song, Good Morning.
Okay. Good morning. Just, good morning.
Different song. if you want to not strike, one of the first things you might do if you have a disagreement is file a grievance. And like I said, when it comes time to sit down, hopefully you can both work things out at the old bargaining table.
Well, in the bargaining table, this is a very important point. Strikes occur almost across the board during contract negotiations.
Yeah.
They don't happen during contracts or else you're in a major violation usually of the contract itself.
Right.
This is our contract's coming up and we've been thinking we really don't want mandatory tonsillectomies.
Right.
We want that removed from this past contract.
Yeah.
And the employer says, no, tonsillectomies for everybody. And then you have a problem. There's an issue right here. It's at the bargaining table. It's contract related and it can conceivably lead to a strike.
So there's different kinds of strikes. There are a few that precede the full on no one's coming to work strike. Kind of like a warning shot strike is you can have a sick out or sick in. And that is when you're just sort of saying, here's what could happen. Company owner, factory owner, we're all calling in sick today. And this is what it's going to be like. Imagine this for days and days in a row.
Yeah, you'd hate it, factory owner.
But we're all not feeling well.
Yeah, and there's actually some professions that legally give up the right to strike.
Sure.
But could still conceivably do this. So like cops sometimes come down with what's called blue flu, which is a structured sick out. Among cops.
Yeah.
And it's still following the letter because each cop is saying, I'm taking a sick day, which I am legally afforded.
Yeah.
But all of them are taking it at the same time. So it's a problem.
Yeah. A lot of times, like, if it's a public service that people really count on, firemen, cops.
Yeah. They can't go on strike.
Yeah. It's in
but
their
they
contract.
They can sick out, though.
We can't strike, but we can sick out, or we generally is what we've done is in our contract, we've agreed to arbitration as a means to settle disputes.
Right. But we can
do a blue flu.
Yeah, blue flu. There's also a slowdown too, which I mean.
This is the most passive aggressive, I think.
It really is. It's like, oh, let me make sure that bolt is on again.
Where was that bolt? Where was that wrench? Where did I put that?
Right. It's where, everybody goes to work, but they do their work very slowly.
Yeah.
And again, they're able to get away with this. Because they're following the rules. So if you look at the rule book or handbook of an employee at, say, any kind of manufacturing plant,
yeah,
their job is probably on paper way more detailed and structured than the actual job they carry out as a just a practical matter, right?
Mm-hmm.
If they started to do their job strictly by the book, the amount of time it takes them to make a widget would slow down dramatically as compared to when they cut the corners that they normally cut. And the company is like, yeah, cut those corners because we want to get more widgets out the door.
So is that what they're doing during a slowdown? Is they're technically following everything to the letter?
That's what the Grabster says. This is a Grabster joint, by the way.
That's right. The great Ed Grabanowski.
Yeah. The Grabster suggests that that is the case for a slowdown usually. Although you could also just do your job slower. But
yeah.
If you're doing it by the book, when your boss comes over and is like, you better speed up. Say, hey, I'm making sure that we're following
right.
all the safety precautions.
Yeah. And then finally, you can have a sit down. Well, there's a couple of more. You can have a sit down strike. That is, that may be the most aggressive. That's when you actually go to work,
right?
And you don't work and you don't leave,
right?
Like you have people bring you food and water, and you're like, I'm gonna sit on my stool so no one else can sit on it and do that job.
Your stool, not your stool.
Good point.
Yeah, I think that's the most aggressive. I have hardest core and then an arrow pointing at sit down strike here on my notes, right?
Yeah.
It's not just the most aggressive. It actually affords some additional protections to the worker on strike, right? So one, nobody else can come in and do that work because they're in the way.
Yeah.
They're on the stool. Number two, it prevents them from violence in a lot of ways, or it protects them from violence because they're hanging around very expensive company machinery.
Sure.
So it would be pretty stupid to come at somebody like that with a lead pipe because if they duck, you just broke the company's machine.
Yeah. And if that sounds crazy, we will go in over the myriad examples of violence and strikes and strike busters.
It's just disgusting.
Yeah. So if you think, what do you mean? No one would come after them violently.
Yeah.
It happens.
Listen. Pollyanna.
Yeah.
Just wait.
Wake up.
So it also keeps the person away from the elements. Like you're not out picketing in the rainy weather.
Of Flint, Michigan.
Right. You're just sitting there in the nice plant.
That's right. There can be sympathy strikes. That's when you, either directly or just they decide to call on your brothers and sisters and other unions, maybe in the same industry that feel your pain and they know it's good for them ultimately as well. So they will also go on strike to kind of help your cause.
Right. Exactly. And, some company may call the other company and be like, dude, they're killing me over here. Give them those concessions, please.
Yeah.
Or else I'm not going to be able to make dues this month at the Billionaires Club.
Right.
Buffy will kill me. it might also be sympathy strikes in a, remember I said in the same plant you might have an upholsterer's union, an electrician's
right.
union, a plumber's union. At the same company, other non-affiliated unions
yeah.
may go on strike as well. And that will really put some pressure on that company.
Yeah.
Cause they can be like, well, we'll catch up with our backlog of upholstery work while these guys are striking.
Right.
Nope. Sorry. We're on strike too. The company owners just like, oh my God, I hate Mondays.
Well, and we're going to get into the very infamous 1980s air traffic controller strike in great detail later. But one of the big reasons it didn't work out is because they failed to get anyone else on board, like the pilots and the flight attendants and baggage handlers. None of them jumped on board with a sympathy strike, which did not help the air traffic controllers.
Then you've got a general strike. Which is not usually directed at a company itself. It's more directed at like a government because that means basically everybody who works in a country goes on strike.
Yeah, like we want minimum wage raise for everybody.
And that's one reason why it seems like France is always striking. It's because when they go on strike, they go on strike. They typically have general strikes when they do. I don't want to say typically, but they do undertake general strikes.
Yeah.
Which is basically unheard of here in the United States.
Yeah.
And it makes big news when it happens.
Yeah, for sure.
So there's just some types of strikes.
Yeah. Should we take a break?
Let's.
All right. But we're coming back. We're not going on strike. Don't worry.
Stuff you should know.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, we have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
So, Chuck, we talked about different kinds of strikes, right?
We did.
One of the things that you think of when you go on strike, or when you think of strike, is people picketing.
Yeah.
Like, you'll very frequently see people around Atlanta, especially it seems like a lot of construction companies have aggrieved employees.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so the people just be, like, marching out in front of the building that's going up, headquarters maybe, yeah, or a construction site, and they'll say, like, shame on whoever,
right,
for employing non-union workers or whatever. Because that's a big part of the ability to go on strike is you need to have a solid union, right?
Yeah.
And one way, especially early on, back in the 18th and early 19th century, we were talking about in New England, there was this idea that, if you were not a part of the union members would be like, I'm not working if that person's working here.
Right.
Like, you have to fire that person. So if you didn't join a union, you had a hard time finding jobs.
Yeah.
And so if you're a union, one of your big tactics is you need to make sure your membership is almost complete across a company,
mm-hmm,
or else you're not going to be able to put real pressure on that company if half the workers can still show up to work.
Yeah.
Because they're not union members, so they're not going on strike.
Yeah. Good point. Picketing is one of the main reasons you picket is to draw, like we mentioned earlier, get the public on your side. It's a big part of it. And
also to embarrass the company.
Yeah. And this probably says a lot about who I am, but whenever I see that, I always think in my head, well, there's some employees that are clearly getting screwed by the man.
Sure.
What do they have to say?
Right.
Which is exactly what they want. That's why they're out there with the picket signs. Sometimes they're chanting something or singing a song. And what they do.
It's true.
They sing songs. Like, you know, songs about the picket. They're not out there singing Stairway to Heaven.
Or like the Freddy Krueger nursery rhyme.
What's that? Oh, 1-2 Freddy. Yeah.
Yeah.
They should do that.
That'd be unsettling.
That'd be the creepiest picket line ever. 1-2 strikers coming for you. If you cross the picket line, you literally have to, that's why they stand out in front,
right,
of the factory or the HQ. You have to walk through them and literally cross the picket line to be what's known as a scab.
Yeah.
And you can be part of that union and decide to go back to work, or you can be just an outside person who says, I actually need work and I'm not in your union. I don't know you guys. Sorry. And ladies, just pardon me. I'm a scab.
Or, you might be a professional from another part of the country that the owner basically has shipped in,
right,
to replace you, which we'll get into all the legalities of that later. But crossing a picket line is not a shining moment for anybody who's doing it.
No. And where does the word scab come from, my friend?
Apparently it has to do with how people used to shun people with infectious diseases. The sentiment was that if you crossed the picket line, you would be treated in the exact same way as if you had the plague.
Right.
Everybody's going to keep you over there. No one's going to talk to you. You're not going to be able to find a job. You're going to be cast out of society.
You're scabbed.
Yes. So it was shortened to scab. Which is, that amount of pressure is tremendous.
Yeah, and picketing doesn't always mean you're on strike. A lot of times it's another warning shot. It's called informational picketing.
Right.
When you sort of threaten and say, hey, you know, we're out here picketing. You know, this does not look good for you.
No. And that's a key thing. Like, if you go on strike, you want the public to know you're on strike.
Yeah.
Because the public's like, why are you on strike? What's the problem? I want to know about that.
Right.
And it's gotten some groups have gotten a lot better at manipulating the media, using social media to get the message across, like the Fight for 15.
I haven't heard that.
Where they're trying to raise the minimum wage to $15.
Yeah, yeah.
They've been putting a tremendous amount of pressure on McDonald's. They got a study released that found that a ridiculous percentage of fast food workers, especially at McDonald's, but in other fast food restaurants in the U.S. too, are reliant on welfare.
Yeah.
On public assistance. And that the way the study framed it and the way that the news reports framed it was that McDonald's was basically using your taxpayer dollars to supplement the meager income they were paying these people,
yeah,
rather than actually pay their employees a living wage.
Right.
They were just being like, you handle it, taxpayers. We're not going to pay them that much.
Right.
And it worked big time. Like, it made all the news cycles. It really changed a lot of people's perspectives. And it went hand in hand with a general strike. Well, not a general strike, but a strike that was carried out, I think, in April of last year across the world.
Yeah.
And it really put a lot of pressure on McDonald's. Didn't do anything.
Right.
But it still put a lot of pressure on McDonald's, and I think ultimately probably will lead to a change in the minimum wage.
Yeah, that's a tricky subject.
Have we talked about that?
No. We should do one on that, because I'm a champion of the people. I think people should make a living wage too, but, you know, my wife is a small business owner, and it would put her out of business.
Yeah.
So, like, when you hear McDonald's, you think, huge corporation, they can afford it.
Yeah.
But what about when you're a small business that has 8 employees and your cost of, what do you call it?
Cost of business?
Well, not cost of business, but your wages go up by 40%.
Sure. No, I agree.
It's a very tough thing to say across the board, everyone has to do this.
But so, like, with Obamacare, and if anybody knows what some solutions are to that, we'd love to hear it.
Yeah.
Cause this fascinates me as well. And it feels very important. But it seemed like with Obamacare, there was a concession made where employers with X number of employees or less weren't mandated to provide health care to their employees.
Yeah, so maybe it would be like that.
Right.
Just
or if
small
your
business,
revenue is
yeah,
less than a certain threshold or whatever, then...
Yes,
you know,
small business can mean a lot of things.
Like, there's no reason that Mama and McDonald's should be in the same basket of considerations for just about anything that has to do with wages or taxes or
yeah,
anything like that.
Agreed.
You know, and it's just
yeah,
so disingenuous to be like, well, you know, what about small business? It's like, well, let the small businesses speak. You can't point to these guys. Like, that doesn't matter to you, international conglomerate.
Yeah, plus McDonald's, they just raised the price on everything on their menu by one penny, and it probably covers it.
I think I've heard a stat like that. I don't think it's just a penny, but
right,
it's something very meager like that.
Yeah. Boy, that was sidetracked, but good one.
But as we'll learn...
It's a can of worms, my
friend. It really is. As we'll learn, though, in this episode, the history of strikes and of labor laws and the treatment of employees and the government like backing employers has been a history of like huge, massive, radical acts. And then like that changed everything.
Yeah.
And then that side won. And then the other side like bides its time and then bam, they strike or they carry out some crazy action and like it changes everything.
Yeah.
The history has been like kind of seesawed like that.
Yeah.
And it's pretty fascinating.
Maybe that provides balance in some way, you know?
Overall, I guess.
Should we talk about sports strikes?
Yeah.
They often get way more attention than other kinds of strikes. because there's so much money and people in the United States love their sports.
Yeah. They value sports over, say, electricians.
Yeah.
You know?
Of course they do. In 1987, the NFL, the Football League, went on strike over free agency, which, if you don't know anything about football, that means after your first contract is up, that means you are a free agent and you can say, I want to go sign with any other team in the league.
Yeah, I don't understand that. What were the, like, that makes total sense. Like, how would that even be a term?
Well,
free agency. What were the teams wanting, the owners?
They wanted, if you drafted
like
that player, for you to have the rights to control that player for as long as you wanted that player.
Oh, God.
All the sports leagues are so different in how they handle things, too. It's really interesting. And I know not many, we don't have a ton of sports fans. Because historically, our sports
terrible, done poorly.
But we'll go over this real quick. They striked in 1987 in the middle of a season, not in the middle, but the beginning. The players walked after two games into the 87 season, and for three games, the NFL said, "You know what? We're going to bring in scab replacement players."
Yeah,
and it was a disaster.
Keanu Reeves. That British dude with the cigarettes.
Yeah. I mean, people, some college players, some players in other, like the Canadian League, some dudes that were just like, hey, I used to play football.
Right.
Like, we're literally out there, out of shape. I mean, some ESPN has a great article on that season.
Oh, really?
How, like, you know, the quarterbacks were in the huddle being like, we just want to be in the huddle as long as possible.
Oh, I've got to check that out.
Nobody can catch their breath because they're, you know, this guy was a fat corporate cat.
Really?
Decided he wanted to be an offensive lineman, scab player. Because he played in college. So it was a disaster. They paid him about $4,000 a game. And the quality of play was terrible, as you would expect. Some high-profile players ended up crossing and being scabs, like Joe Montana.
Oh, really?
Tony Dorsett, Lawrence Taylor.
Wow.
Steve Largent.
Wow.
And it was a big deal. And eventually they returned to work and without any resolution, which happens a lot of times.
Thanks to Joe Montana.
Baseball in 19, they've gone on strike a lot. In 1984, though, the MLB Players Association said.
84 or 94?
94.
94.
Did I say 84?
Yeah.
They said, we don't want a salary cap on our team, which if you don't know what that means, it means a team can only spend so much money on its players.
Right.
Players hate that because they want as much money as possible. Owners love it because.
They're like, oh, well, what am I going to do with all this extra money?
Exactly. And in 1994, in August, sort of late in the season, they actually canceled the rest of the season.
Yeah.
And the World Series.
Which yes.
stunk because the Braves were, that was in the middle of their big run.
And they, oh yeah, that's right.
You know, like we lost an opportunity to lose another World Series.
We won that one though, right?
Yeah, one.
So, apparently this contract dispute was still going on into spring training. And some players went and reported to spring training. Despite the strike still going on. And those players were banned for life
from
the players union.
I don't think I knew that.
For life, which means that even after retirement, they weren't eligible for any royalties that you get.
Oh, wow.
From like your number being licensed or being on like, MLB 95 or whatever.
Retirement edition.
Yeah. but I mean, you can, you know, make some checks depending on how great a player you were and how big your legend was for many years after you retire. But if you cross the picket lines and went to spring training, nope, you're out.
I don't think I knew that.
Yeah.
National Hockey League historically has only had one official strike, but they have, been locked out, which we'll get to lockouts shortly, but they've been locked out a couple of times. And, the entire, 2004 season was canceled. The whole thing. And, hockey and Major League Baseball had a much more difficult time recovering from their canceled season and canceled World Series than the NFL.
Huh.
From their scab issue.
I've got a scab issue.
And in 2012, the referees, NFL referees were locked out.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that? They had replacement referees that were just terrible.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
They actually, I think...
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, We have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Must have won that concession for the regular referees, because it was that got so much bad press. Everybody was so mad. They were making so many bad calls. Yeah. I totally forgot about that.
They have like high school referees out there refereeing NFL games.
Yeah.
Should we take a break?
I think so, man.
All right. We'll talk about strike busting and more right after this.
Stuff you should know.
So, Chuckers, if you are an employer and your employees go on strike, you don't just go, oh, fiddlesticks, I guess I'll give them what they want.
Yeah.
There are plenty of other things you can do, some legal, some sublegal, and some in between, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the first things that employers did when they were faced with strikes early on was hire armed mercenaries to basically beat up and threaten and harass the striking workers.
Yeah, notably the Pinkerton Detective Agency. They did a lot of detective work, but they were also notable for being strike breakers. And some of the things they do are legit, like guarding scabs as they go to work so they're not harassed.
Right.
Or protecting the building itself so it's not, you know, they're not throwing bricks through the windows.
Right.
But there's also, you know, they're getting beaten up sometimes and intimidated.
Well, not just that. They also may serve as agent provocateurs. Apparently, the Haymarket riot,
which
left a bunch of cops dead in Chicago.
Yeah.
It was set off by a bomb, and they think that a Pinkerton detective undercover set that bomb off to, like, stir this protest into an angry, violent mob.
So they basically do anything for money.
Yeah. And apparently, I was reading that Pinkerton was hired to investigate the Occupy Wall Street protesters in Ducati Park.
So oh, really?
Still at it.
Wow.
Yeah. And so Pinkerton, for they deserve their own podcast episode
totally.
For sure.
Yeah.
But very early on, they were hired as basically armed thugs. Like you said, they did do protective services, but they also did a lot of violent and illegal stuff as well on the behalf of these factory owners. And there was one in particular where the factory owners, it was Andrew Carnegie, actually, in Homestead, Pennsylvania. There's a steel mill there. And at the steel mill, in, I think, 1884, the workers went on strike. So Carnegie brought in some Hungarian and Slavic steel workers to replace them. And in 1892, the Hungarian and Slavic steel workers went on strike themselves. And more workers were brought in to replace them. And both times, Pinkerton detectives were there to escort the scabs across the picket line.
Yeah.
Even when those scabs they escorted turned into the striking workers themselves.
Right.
But it's kind of like one of those things where it's like, maybe the couple, second time it might be you.
Right.
You know, if the scabs you brought in go on strike too.
Yeah. Maybe we should pay them a little more.
Right, exactly.
Well, make things safer.
That's not what happened. There was like a, basically what's called the Battle of Homestead, and it was a battle between the Pinkerton detectives and these striking workers. And in this case, actually, the Pinkertons suffered massive losses and casualties. They were beaten by the townsfolk in Homestead.
Three of them died.
And it actually turned public opinion against the strikers in this case.
Yeah.
But it also taught Pinkerton that, like, it's probably not good business to, like, send our boys off to die.
Yeah.
So they actually stopped providing strike-breaking services over time. And it morphed and evolved into more arranging for spies to attend union meetings and things like that.
Yeah, there's still strike busting going on. It's just right. not as overt and physically violent.
Right.
Yeah. A little more surreptitious and sneaky.
And then, remember we said Wake Up Pollyanna earlier.
Yeah.
That's a good example of it. Another good example is the Great Strike of 1877, which started in Martinsburg, West Virginia, and actually spread very quickly to towns like Baltimore and St. Louis. And it made its way, too, to Pittsburgh, so the Homestead one was 1892. Just a few years earlier, in 1877, there was another strike, and a bunch of townspeople were out supporting the strikers, and the I think the state National Guard came in and opened fire on the supporters of the strikers and killed 20 people, including a woman and three small children. So, like, strikes have gotten very bloody, especially early on. And the fact that people were dying over these labor disputes really kind of shaped public sentiment toward violence during strikes, and it helped straighten things up a lot more, I think, over time.
Yeah, agreed. Well, I know we covered it in the Unions podcast, but we should talk a little bit about the Wagner Act and Taft-Hartley, because they play very heavily into strikes. The Wagner Act, a.k.a. the National Labor Relations Act, was what officially said you have a right, among other things, you have a right to strike.
Right.
You can form unions, you can go on strike. And
it specifically says you have a right to strike.
Yeah, you are legally allowed to do so if you know, and they didn't specify, like, what kind of votes. Like, that was all up to the union.
Right, but it said you are allowed to settle labor disputes by striking.
That's right.
Explicitly.
Is right.
And then the Supreme Court came along and said, yeah, let's weaken that a little bit.
Yeah, in 1938, the Supreme Court said, you know what? You can't fire people for joining a union or going on strike, but what you can do is permanently replace them with another worker.
Right.
And if you want to know the difference, there isn't much. Technically, if you are permanently replaced, you can go back to that job if the person who replaced you quits or retires or is mm-hmm. fired and that position becomes available again.
You have the right to go back to that position.
Yeah, and get your job.
That could be 20 years from now.
Or never.
Right.
Yeah.
Like Kramer with the bagel strike.
Yeah.
You remember?
Yeah.
And so it is legal to permanently replace somebody. And when it comes down to a strike, this weapon in the employer's arsenal is as good as being able to fire striking workers in a lot of cases.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that was a big one. And a lot of people, especially pro-labor people, point to this and say, what the heck, Supreme Court? Like, Congress explicitly passed an act that says, overtly, you have a right to strike. There's nowhere in American law that says employers have a right to replace their striking workers. And yet the Supreme Court has erred on the side of employers' rights.
Well, I think what the Supreme Court said was, sure, you can go on strike, but we're not going to say you can go on strike with no repercussions.
Right.
Taft-Hartley Amendment came around in 1947 and did a few things. It established the National Labor Review Board, which is a body that hears grievances on strikes and unions,
right.
Supposedly impartial. That's what they're supposed to be.
Sue them.
Oh, is that?
Yeah, after that, all of the lawsuits or cases that have to do with strikes are all somebody versus the NLRB.
Good point. And the other thing it did was it did weaken unions somewhat by saying you can't have a secondary boycott, which is when you strike against another related business in that industry that's original, like that's targeted by the original strike.
Right.
You can't have a closed shop, which is where you have to join a union as terms of your employment.
Immediately.
Yeah, like right away. But they did allow for what's known as a union shop, which means you have to join a union within the first, within a time period, 30 days of hire. Although most states now have taken it into their own hands in some cases, not most, but to be a right to work state, which Georgia is, which means the union shop is irrelevant.
Right.
I wonder how many right to work states there are, actually. I meant to look that up.
I don't know. Georgia, it's such a cynical way to put it, a right to work. Like, it's the worker's right to not join a union. Like, that's not a pro, employer law, you know?
Yeah.
So Chuck, another tool in the employer's, toolbox, I guess. Yeah, that makes sense. Is the lockout. And it's apparently being used more and more these days. The lockout is like the reverse strike. It's where the employer says,
you can't come to work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even if you want to. Even if you want to stop striking. And there's rules and regulations surrounding lockouts as well. The Supreme Court, or Taft-Hartley, one of the two, said, you can, as an employer, lock your employees out once a contract is expired. So you can't do it during the contract. But if you're an employer and you're saying, I really, really, really want to shove my terms down your throat, you have to accept them. And the union saying, no, we're not going to accept that. You can sit there and negotiate, negotiate, negotiate. And then once that contract expires during negotiations, you can say, you're locked out. You can't come to work.
Yeah.
And the Supreme Court also ruled that you are, as an employer, allowed to temporarily replace those workers that you've locked out, right? So,
like the scabs in the NFL.
Very much so, right?
Yeah.
So you're allowed to replace them and continue on with your business as usual. And then if you're a union member, you're faced with three options. One, you can go find work at another company.
Yeah.
Two, you can accept the terms. And then three, what's becoming an increasing tactic is you can vote to dissolve the union.
Right.
That even when you come back and say, okay, we'll accept your terrible contract, the employer can go, you know what? I changed my mind. I actually don't want this union in my company any longer.
Yeah.
So I'll tell you what, if you guys vote to dissolve your union, then we will, we'll go with this contract and the lockout will be over.
That happened very famously in Minnesota. In August of 2011, the American Crystal Sugar Company found that employees found that they were locked out, and it went on. It's one of the longest labor disruptions, like major labor disruptions we've had.
Mm-hmm.
Went on for 22 months.
Man,
1,300 employees were locked out. By the time it was all over, only 400 of those original 1,300 came back. Those almost 2 years later, and it took. Basically, Crystal Sugar kept saying, this is our only offer. This is our only offer.
Right.
Every time they went back to negotiate, this is our final offer. So it took five votes over the course of almost 2 years, until they eventually relented and, accepted that same offer.
Right.
Like, they never changed the offer.
Yeah.
And supposedly there was, the CEO, Dave Berg, was caught on audio tape, at a shareholder conference saying, basically admitting that they were trying to bust the union.
And comparing the union to a tumor that had to be removed.
Yeah, he said, we have to treat the disease, and that's what we're doing here. And then in 3 months into the lockout, he told shareholders, we mapped this out a long time ago. At some point, that tumor's got to come out, and that's what we're doing. And it worked.
Yeah, it did. So then we should end with the Reagan air traffic controller strike.
Boy, man, I remember this.
Do you really?
Oh, yeah.
So in 1981, the air traffic controllers went on strike because they felt that the FAA didn't value their work enough, that their work week was too long, that their pay was too low, and that their working conditions led to unsafe conditions for travelers.
Yeah, all legit stuff. It wasn't all of them. 13,000 of the 17,500, and at the time they were the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, PATCO.
So, we talked earlier about how a good labor union leadership will say, even though you guys want to go on strike, this is a terrible time to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, PATCO did not do that. They went on strike at a time when the economy was not doing that well, when Reagan had about 100% approval. He'd just been shot and recovered, so mm-hmm. he came back like a total hero. And he was riding high and felt pretty emboldened, actually. And the reason why the union went on strike anyway was because they had supported Reagan. He had gotten their support through negotiations, and they didn't view him as somebody who was an enemy.
Yeah, they mishandled and misjudged this in many, many, many ways.
But supposedly, there's a 1955 law that says if you're a government agency, your union can't go on strike. The thing was, in practicality, in actuality, there had been something like 22 strikes over the last few decades of government unions, and it was just kind of like an unsaid thing. Well, Reagan said, no, this is illegal, and you guys are, if you don't return to work in 48 hours, you're all fired. I'm going to arrest your union leaders for carrying out an illegal strike.
Yeah, I'm going to arrest some of the controllers themselves.
Right. I'm going to freeze the assets of the union, and then I'm going to get the union decertified. And he did all these things.
Yeah. I'm going to put the FBI's getting involved. If you're a striker, you're going to be on their list.
Yeah.
And this all came down to money, really. It was, what they were after would have increased, had a price tag of about $770 million. The FAA countered with a $40 million counteroffer. A little bit of a pay hike, a shorter work week, and Patco said no. So when they went on strike, 6,000 flights, were immediately canceled. And I think they just underestimated how hardcore, the FAA and Reagan were going to be coming back at them, because they had a plan.
Oh, yeah.
Immediately they said, you know what? We're going to have 50% of these flights back and running very soon, because your supervisors are going to go to work. We're going to rush through matriculation and training school.
And military air traffic controllers.
And then bring in these military folks to come in, and we don't need you. And I think within a few weeks, they had nearly 80% of the scheduled flights going, like prioritizing the most like trafficked routes and what they considered high priority routes.
Right, which is a terrible irony, because that is almost exactly what the air traffic controllers were looking for, was stretched out work. That they felt was safer. And that's what Reagan got it to.
Yeah.
With the replacements.
Well, yeah, and it ended up costing them, I think, twice as much money as it would have cost them if they had just agreed to those terms.
Right. And a lot of people point to that, the fact that the FAA ended up changing to what the strikers wanted.
Right.
And spending twice as much as what they would have just conceding to it, as Reagan changing the flow between employer and employees.
Yeah.
And he did dramatically. After that, it became much more difficult to strike. And I think it struck fear into the hearts of workers throughout the country. Like, oh man, the president himself feels this way about striking. Like, that clearly he's going to back up, the employers in any kind of strike. And it changed things for sure.
Yeah. And I mean, not only did he say, you're all fired, he said, none of you can ever work for the government again.
Right.
And then Bill Clinton came along and reversed that and said, you guys can get a job again if you want.
They said, well, half of us are dead.
Yeah. Well, that was 12 years later, when that happened. So that's a good point. But eventually they, the newly hired air traffic controllers formed a new union, NATCA, National Air Traffic Controllers Association. And, I think, Robert Polley from Patco said, you know, ultimately, I think we sort of won because it ended up costing them more and we got the changes, but mm-hmm. There were no winners, really.
Yeah.
Because they lost because all those people got fired.
Capital won.
Yeah. And that was a big one at the time. We talked about getting the public sympathy. They did not have it because air traffic controllers made more than the average person. And like you said, it was a bad time for the economy, and people's flights were getting canceled, and they didn't have, what do we call them, the sympathy strikers.
Right.
So they thought it through.
And they were very much surprised by Reagan, for sure.
They're like, he said, what? We're all fired in 2 days?
Yeah. So that strikes, there's a lot more to it. There's a crazy history that we haven't even touched on. there's just so much stuff that's happened as far as strikes go.
Yeah.
You should definitely, if this floats your boat at all, you should go look up the Flint, Michigan sit-in strike of, I think, 1938.
Yeah.
It was pretty amazing what happened.
Yeah, and we might should do an entire show on the Homestead strike and battle.
Yes.
That was a big deal.
Yes, it is. Was.
Yeah, I think it's full enough for a show.
Okay. Well, in the meantime, if you want to know more about strikes, you can type that word in the search bar at howstuffworks.com. And I said search bar, so it's time for listener mail.
I'm going to call this Navy Lieutenant reporting for duty. Hey, guys, I'm a lieutenant in the Navy, and I've been listening to your show for a few years. Started listening while I was stationed in Japan and have not stopped. You asked about ship name prefixes, specifically USS, which indeed is United States ship. It should be noted that this specifically refers to warships of the U.S. Navy, and the prefixes for other ships of the U.S. government are Legion. For instance, USCGC, United States Coast Guard Cutter, USNS, United States Naval Ship, non-warship, USAS, United States Army Ship, USAV, United States Army Vessel, and many more boutique prefixes that are limited, they're of limited use or no longer in use. Most navies around the world have their own prefixes. Like you said, HMS currently is Her Majesty's Ship or Her Majesty's Submarine. But when the monarch, reigning monarch is a man, a king, it would be His Majesty's Ship. Which makes sense.
Yes.
And how about these, Josh? HMCS, His or Her Majesty's Canadian Ship. Or HMAS, Australian Ship. Or HMNZS, His Majesty's New Zealand Ship. Civilian ships, vessels can have prefixes as well according to their construction and propulsion, such as SS, I never knew that, like SS Minnow, sailing ship.
Wow.
Or steamship or screw steamer.
Yeah, okay.
Which is the dirtiest of all ships. MV or M/V for motor vessel. And then my personal favorite, that is Chris speaking, NS for nuclear ship.
Ooh.
The number of them is staggering, guys. Very respectfully, Chris, Lieutenant in the U.S. Navy.
Well, ahoy, Chris. Thanks a lot for that. If you want to get in touch with us like Chris and shine some light on some stuff we didn't really know about, we love that. So, you can tweet to us at SYSK Podcast. You can join us on Facebook.com/StuffYouShouldKnow. You can send us an email to StuffPodcast@HowStuffWorks.com. And as always, join us at our home on the web, StuffYouShouldKnow.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.